Chapter 8. A Law That Will Outlaw Many of Your Worries. As a child, I grew up on a Missouri farm, and one day, while helping my mother pit cherries, I began to cry. My mother said, "Dale, what in the world are you crying about?" I blubbered, "I'm afraid I'm going to be buried alive." I was full of worries in those days. When thunderstorms came, I worried for fear I would be killed by lightning. When hard times came, I worried for fear we wouldn't have enough to eat. I worried for fear I would go to hell when I died. I was terrified for fear of an older boy, Sam White, would cut off my big ears, as he threatened to do. I worried for fear girls would laugh at me if I tipped my hat to them. I worried for fear no girl would ever be willing to marry me. I worried about what I would say to my wife immediately after we were married. I imagined that we would be married in some country church, and then get in a surrey with a fringe on top and ride back to the farm. But how would I be able to keep the conversation going on that ride back to the farm? How? I pondered over that earth-shaking problem for many an hour as I walked behind the plow. As the years went by, I gradually discovered that 99% of the things I worried about never happened. For example, as I've already said, I was once terrified of lightning. But I now know that the chances of my being killed by lightning in any one year are, according to the National Safety Council, only 1 in 350,000. My fear of being buried alive was even more absurd. I don't imagine that even back in the days before embalming was the rule, that 1 person in 10 million was buried alive, yet I once cried for fear of it. 1 person out of every 8 dies of cancer. If I had wanted something to worry about, I should have worried about cancer instead of being killed by lightning or being buried alive. To be sure, I've been talking about the worries of youth and adolescence, but many of our adult worries are almost as absurd. You and I could probably eliminate 9/10 of our worries right now if we would cease our fretting long enough to discover whether, by the law of averages, there was any real justification for our worries. The most famous insurance company on earth, Lloyd's of London, has made countless millions of dollars out of the tendency of everybody to worry about things that rarely happen. Lloyd's of London bets people that the disasters they're worrying about will never occur. However, they don't call it betting, they call it insurance. But it is really betting based on the law of averages. This great insurance firm has been going strong for over 200 years, and unless human nature changes, it will still be going strong 50 centuries from now by insuring shoes and ships and sealing wax against disasters that, by the law of averages, don't happen nearly so often as people imagine. If we examine the law of averages, we will often be astounded at the facts we uncover. For example, if I knew that during the next 5 years I would have to fight in a battle as bloody as the Battle of Gettysburg, I would be terrified. I would take out all the life insurance I could get. I would draw up my will and set all my earthly affairs in order. I would say, "I'll probably never live through that battle, so I had better make the most of the few years I have left." Yet the facts are that, according to the law of averages, it is just as dangerous, just as fatal, to try to live from age 50 to age 55 in peacetime as it was to fight in the Battle of Gettysburg. What I'm trying to say is this. In times of peace, just as many people die per thousand between the ages of 50 and 55, as were killed per thousand among the 163,000 soldiers who fought at Gettysburg. I wrote several chapters of this book at James Simpson's Numtigah Lodge on the shores of Bow Lake in the Canadian Rockies. While stopping there one summer, I met Mr. and Mrs. Herbert H. Salinger of San Francisco. Mrs. Salinger, a poised, serene woman, gave me the impression that she had never worried. One evening, in front of the roaring fireplace, I asked her if she had ever been troubled by worry. "Troubled by it," she said. "My life was almost ruined by it. Before I learned to conquer worry, I lived through 11 years of self-made hell. I was irritable and hot-tempered. I lived under terrific tension. I would take the bus every week from my home in San Mateo to shop in San Francisco. But even while shopping, I worried myself into a dither. Maybe I had left the electric iron connected on the ironing board. Maybe the house had caught fire. Maybe the maid had run off and left the children. Maybe they had been out on their bicycles and been killed by a car. In the midst of my shopping, I would often worry myself into a cold perspiration and rush out and take the bus home to see if everything was all right. No wonder my first marriage ended in disaster. My second husband is a lawyer, a quiet, analytical man who never worries about anything. When I became tense and anxious, he would say to me, "Relax, let's think this thing out. What are you really worrying about? Let's examine the law of averages and see whether or not it is likely to happen." For example, I remember the time we were driving from Albuquerque, New Mexico, to the Carlsbad Caverns, driving on a dirt road when we were caught in a terrible rainstorm. The car was slithering and sliding. We couldn't control it. I was positive we would slide off into one of the ditches that flanked the road, but my husband kept repeating to me, "I am driving very slowly. Nothing serious is likely to happen. Even if the car does slide into the ditch, by the law of averages, we won't be hurt." His calmness and confidence quieted me. One summer, we were on a camping trip in the Tocan Valley of the Canadian Rockies. One night, we were camping 7,000 feet above sea level when a storm threatened to tear our tent to shreds. The tents were tied with guy ropes to a wooden platform. The outer tent shook and trembled and screamed and shrieked in the wind. I expected every minute to see our tent torn loose and hurled through the sky. I was terrified. But my husband kept saying, "Look, my dear, we are traveling with Brewster's guides. Brewsters know what they're doing. They've been pitching tents in these mountains for 60 years. This tent has been here for many seasons. It hasn't blown down yet, and by the law of averages, it won't blow away tonight. And even if it does, we can take shelter in another tent. So relax." I did, and I slept soundly the balance of the night. A few years ago, an infantile paralysis epidemic swept over our part of California. In the old days, I would have been hysterical, but my husband persuaded me to act calmly. We took all the precautions we could. We kept our children away from crowds, away from school and the movies. By consulting the Board of Health, we found out that even during the worst infantile paralysis epidemic that California had ever known up to that time, only 1,835 children had been stricken in the entire state of California, and that the usual number was around 200 or 300. Tragic as those figures are, we nevertheless felt that, according to the law of averages, the chances of any one child being stricken were remote. By the law of averages, it won't happen. That phrase has destroyed 90% of my worries and has made the past 20 years of my life beautiful and peaceful beyond my highest expectations. It has been said that nearly all of our worries and unhappiness come from our imagination and not from reality. As I look back across the decades, I can see that is where most of my worries came from also. Jim Grant told me that that had been his experience, too. He owned the James A. Grant Distributing Company of New York City. He ordered from 10 to 15 carloads of Florida oranges and grapefruit at a time. He told me that he used to torture himself with such thoughts as, "What if there's a train wreck? What if my fruit is strewn all over the countryside? What if a bridge collapses as my cars are going over it?" Of course, the fruit was insured, but he feared that if he didn't deliver his fruit on time, he might risk the loss of his market. He worried so much that he feared he had stomach ulcers and went to a doctor. The doctor told him there was nothing wrong with him except jumpy nerves. "I saw the light then," he said, "and began to ask myself questions. I said to myself, 'Look here, Jim Grant, how many fruit cars have you handled over the years?' And the answer was about 25,000. Then I asked myself, 'How many of those cars were ever wrecked?' The answer was, maybe 5. Then I said to myself, 'Only 5 out of 25,000. Do you know what that means? A ratio of 5,000 to 1. In other words, by the law of averages, based on experience, the chances are 5,000 to 1 against one of your cars ever being wrecked. So, what are you worried about? And then I said to myself, well, a bridge may collapse. Then I asked myself, how many cars have you actually lost from a bridge collapsing? The answer was none. Then I said to myself, aren't you a fool to be worrying yourself into stomach ulcers over a bridge which has never yet collapsed and over a railroad wreck when the chances are 5,000 to 1 against it? When I looked at it that way, Jim Grant told me, I felt pretty silly. I decided then and there to let the law of averages do the worrying for me, and I have not been troubled with my stomach ulcer since. When Al Smith was governor of New York, I heard him answer the attacks of his political enemies by saying over and over, "Let's examine the record. Let's examine the record." Then he proceeded to give the facts. The next time you and I are worrying about what may happen, let's take a tip from wise old Al Smith. Let's examine the record and see what basis there is, if any, for our gnawing anxieties. That's precisely what Frederick J. Malmsteed did when he feared he was lying in his grave. Here's his story as he told it to one of our classes in New York. Early in June 1944, I was lying in a slit trench near Omaha Beach. I was with the 999th Signal Service Company. We'd just dug in Normandy. As I looked around to that slit trench, just a rectangular hole in the ground, I said to myself, "This looks just like a grave." When I lay down and tried to sleep in it, it felt like a grave. I couldn't help saying to myself, "Maybe this is my grave." When the German bombers began coming over at 11 p.m. and the bombs started falling, I was scared stiff. For the first two or three nights, I couldn't sleep at all. By the fourth or fifth night, I was almost a nervous wreck. I knew that if I didn't do something, I would go stark crazy. So I reminded myself that five nights had passed and I was still alive, and so was every man in our outfit. Only two had even been injured, and they had been hurt not by the German bombs, but by falling flak from our own anti-aircraft guns. I decided to stop worrying by doing something constructive. So I built a thick wooden roof over my slit trench to protect myself from flak. I thought of the vast area over which my unit was spread. I told myself that the only way I could be killed in that deep, narrow slit trench was by a direct hit. And I figured out that the chance of a direct hit on me was not 1 in 10,000. After a couple of nights of looking at it in this way, I calmed down and slept even through the bomb raids. The United States Navy used the statistics of the law of averages to buck up the morale of their men. One ex-sailor told me that when he and his shipmates were assigned to high-octane tankers, they were worried stiff. They all believed that if a tanker loaded with high-octane gasoline was hit by a torpedo, it exploded and blew everybody to kingdom come. But the U.S. Navy knew otherwise. So the Navy issued exact figures, showing that out of 100 tankers hit by torpedoes, 60 stayed afloat. And of the 40 that did sink, only 5 sank in less than 10 minutes. That meant time to get off the ship. It also meant casualties were exceedingly small. Did this help morale? This knowledge of the law of averages wiped out my jitters, said Clyde W. Moss of St. Paul, Minnesota, the man who told the story. The whole crew felt better. We knew we had a chance, and that by the law of averages we probably wouldn't be killed. To break the worry habit before it breaks you, here is Rule 3. Let's examine the record. Let's ask ourselves, what are the chances, according to the law of averages, that this event I am worrying about will ever occur? Chapter 9. Cooperate with the inevitable. When I was a little boy, I was playing with some of my friends in the attic of an old abandoned log house in northwest Missouri. As I climbed down out of the attic, I rested my feet on a windowsill for a moment and then jumped. I had a ring on my left forefinger, and as I jumped, the ring caught on a nail head and tore off my finger. I screamed. I was terrified. I was positive I was going to die. But after the hand healed, I never worried about it for one split second. What would have been the use? I accepted the inevitable. And now I often go for a month at a time without even thinking about the fact that I have only three fingers and a thumb on my left hand. A few years ago, I met a man who was running a freight elevator in one of the downtown office buildings in New York. I noticed that his left hand had been cut off at the wrist. I asked him if the loss of that hand bothered him. He said, "Oh, no, I hardly ever think about it. I'm not married. The only time I ever think about it is when I try to thread a needle." It's astonishing how quickly we can accept almost any situation, if we have to, and adjust ourselves to it and forget about it. I often think of an inscription on the ruins of a 15th-century cathedral in Amsterdam, Holland. This inscription says, in Flemish, "It is so. It cannot be otherwise." As you and I march across the decades of time, we're going to meet a lot of unpleasant situations that are so. They cannot be otherwise. We have our choice. We can either accept them as inevitable and adjust ourselves to them, or we can ruin our lives with rebellion and maybe end up with a nervous breakdown. Here's a bit of sage advice from one of my favorite philosophers, William James. "Be willing to have it so," he said. "Acceptance of what has happened is the first step to overcoming the consequences of any misfortune." Elizabeth Conley of Portland, Oregon, had to find that out the hard way. Here's a letter that she wrote me. On the very day that America was celebrating the victory of our armed forces in North Africa, the letter says, I received a telegram from the War Department. My nephew, the person I loved most, was missing in action. A short time later, another telegram arrived saying he was dead. I was prostrate with grief. Up to that time, I had felt that life had been very good to me. I had a job I loved. I'd helped to raise this nephew. He represented to me all that was fine and good in young manhood. I had felt that all the bread I had cast upon the waters was coming back to me as cake. Then came this telegram. My whole world collapsed. I felt there was nothing left to live for. I neglected my work, neglected my friends. I let everything go. I was bitter and resentful. Why did my loving nephew have to be taken? Why did this good boy, with life all before him, why did he have to be killed? I couldn't accept it. My grief was so overwhelming that I decided to give up my work and go away and hide myself in tears and bitterness. I was clearing out my desk, getting ready to quit, when I came across a letter that I had forgotten, a letter from this nephew who had been killed, a letter he'd written to me when my mother had died a few years ago. "Of course we will all miss her," the letter said, "and especially you, but I know you'll carry on. Your own personal philosophy will make you do that. I shall never forget the beautiful truths you taught me. Wherever I am, or how far apart we may be, I shall always remember that you taught me to smile and to take whatever comes like a man." I read and reread that letter. It seemed as if he were there beside me, speaking to me. He seemed to be saying to me, "Why don't you do what you taught me to do? Carry on, no matter what happens. Hide your private sorrows under a smile and carry on." So I went back to my work. I stopped being bitter and rebellious. I kept saying to myself, "It is done. I can't change it. But I can and will carry on as he wished me to do." I threw all my mind and strength into my work. I wrote letters to soldiers, to other people's boys. I joined an adult education class at night, seeking out new interests and making new friends. I can hardly believe the change that has come over me. I have ceased mourning over the past that is forever gone. I am living each day now with joy, just as my nephew would have wanted me to do. I have made peace with life. I have accepted my fate. I am now living a fuller and more complete life than I have ever known. Elizabeth Conley learned what all of us will have to learn sooner or later, namely that we must accept and cooperate with the inevitable. It is so, it cannot be otherwise. Now, that's not an easy lesson to learn. Even kings on their thrones have to keep reminding themselves of it. The late George V had these framed words hanging on the wall of his library at Buckingham Palace. "Teach me neither to cry for the moon nor over spilt milk." The same thought is expressed by Schopenhauer in this way. a good supply of resignation is of the first importance in providing for the journey of life. Obviously, circumstances alone do not make us happy or unhappy. It is the way we react to circumstances that determines our feelings. Jesus said that the kingdom of heaven is within you. That is where the kingdom of hell is, too. We can all endure disaster and tragedy and triumph over them if we have to. We may not think we can, but we have surprisingly strong inner resources that will see us through if we will only make use of them. We are stronger than we think. The late Booth Tarkington always said, "I could take anything that life could force upon me except one thing, blindness. I could never endure that." Then one day, when he was along in his 60s, Tarkington glanced down at the carpet on the floor. The colors were blurred. He couldn't see the pattern. He went to a specialist. He learned the tragic truth. He was losing his sight. One eye was nearly blind, and the other would follow. That which he feared most had come upon him. How did Tarkington react to this worst of all disasters? Did he feel, "This is it, this is the end of my life"? No. To his amazement, he felt quite gay. He even called upon his humor. Floating specks annoyed him. They would swim across his eyes and cut off his vision. Yet when the largest of these specks would swim across his sight, he would say, "Hello, there's Grandfather again. Wonder where he's going this fine morning." How could fate ever conquer a spirit like that? Well, the answer is, it couldn't. When total darkness closed in, Tarkington said, "I found I could take the loss of my eyesight just as a man can take anything else. If I lost all five of my senses, I know I could live on inside my mind. For it is in the mind we see, and in the mind we live, whether we know it or not." In the hope of restoring his eyesight, Tarkington had to go through more than 12 operations within 1 year, with local anesthetic. Did he rail against this? He knew it had to be done. He knew he couldn't escape it, so the only way to lessen his suffering was to take it with grace. He refused a private room at the hospital and went into a ward where he could be with other people who had troubles too. He tried to cheer them up. And when he had to submit to repeated operations, fully conscious of what was being done to his eyes, he tried to remember how fortunate he was. "How wonderful," he said, "how wonderful that science now has the skill to operate on anything so delicate as the human eye." The average man would have been a nervous wreck if he had had to endure more than 12 operations and blindness. Yet Tarkington said, "I would not exchange this experience for a happier one." It taught him acceptance. It taught him that nothing life could bring him was beyond his strength to endure. It taught him, as John Milton discovered, that it is not miserable to be blind, it is only miserable not to be able to endure blindness. Margaret Fuller, the famous New England feminist, once offered as her credo, "I accept the universe." When grouchy old Thomas Carlyle heard that in England, he snorted, "By gad, she'd better. Yes, and by gad, you and I had better accept the inevitable, too." If we rail and kick against it and grow bitter, we won't change the inevitable, but we will change ourselves. I know. I've tried it. I once refused to accept an inevitable situation with which I was confronted. I played the fool and railed against it and rebelled. It ruined my nights into hells of insomnia. I brought upon myself everything I didn't want. Finally, after a year of self-torture, I had to accept what I knew from the outset I couldn't possibly alter. I should have cried out years ago with old Walt Whitman, "Oh, to confront night, storms, hunger, ridicule, accident, rebuffs, as the trees and animals do." I spent 12 years working with cattle, yet I never saw a Jersey cow running a temperature because the pasture was burning up from a lack of rain, or because of sleet and cold, or because her boyfriend was paying too much attention to another heifer. The animals confront night, storms, and hunger calmly, so they never have nervous breakdowns or stomach ulcers, and they never go insane. Am I advocating that we simply bow down to all the adversities that come our way? Not by a long shot. That's mere fatalism. As long as there's a chance we can save a situation, let's fight. But when common sense tells us that we're up against something that is so and cannot be otherwise, then in the name of our sanity, let's not look before and after and pine for what is not. The late Dean Hawkes of Columbia University told me that he had taken a Mother Goose rhyme as one of his mottos. For every ailment under the sun, there is a remedy, or there is none. If there be one, try to find it. If there be none, never mind it. While writing this book, I interviewed a number of the leading business executives of America, and I was impressed by the fact that they cooperated with the inevitable and led lives singularly free from worry. If they hadn't done that, they would have cracked under the strain. Here are a few examples of what I mean. J.C. Penney, founder of the nationwide chain of Penney stores, said to me, "I wouldn't worry if I lost every dollar I have, because I don't see what is to be gained by worrying. I do the best job I possibly can and leave the results in the laps of the gods." Henry Ford told me much the same thing. "When I can't handle events," he said, "I let them handle themselves." When I asked K.T. Keller, then president of the Chrysler Corporation, how he kept from worrying, he replied, "When I'm up against a tough situation, if I can do anything about it, I do it. If I can't, I just forget it. I never worry about the future because I know no man living can possibly figure out what's going to happen in the future. There are so many forces that will affect the future. Nobody can tell what prompts these forces or understands them, so why worry about them?" K.T. Keller would be embarrassed if you told him he's a philosopher, he's just a good businessman. Yet he has stumbled onto the same philosophy that Epictetus taught in Rome 19 centuries ago. "There is only one way to happiness," Epictetus taught the Romans, "and that is to cease worrying about things which are beyond the power of our will." Sarah Bernhardt, the divine Sarah, was an illustrious example of a woman who knew how to cooperate with the inevitable. For half a century, she had been the reigning queen of the theater on four continents, the best-loved actress on earth. Then, when she was 71 and broke, she had lost all her money. Her physician, Professor Posey of Paris, told her he would have to amputate her leg. While crossing the Atlantic, she had fallen on deck during a storm and injured her leg severely. Phlebitis developed. Her leg shrank. The pain became so intense that the doctors felt her leg had to be amputated. He was almost afraid to tell the stormy, tempestuous, divine Sarah what had to be done. He fully expected that the terrible news would set off an explosion of hysteria. But he was wrong. Sarah looked at him a moment and then said quietly, "If it has to be, it has to be." It was fate. As she was being wheeled away to the operating room, her son stood weeping. She waved to him with a gay gesture and said cheerfully, "Don't go away, I'll be right back." On the way to the operating room, she recited a scene from one of her plays. Someone asked her if she were doing this to cheer herself up. She said, "No, to cheer up the doctors and nurses. It will be a strain on them." After recovering from the operation, Sarah Bernhardt went on touring the world and enchanting audiences for another 7 years. "When we stop fighting the inevitable," said Elsie McCormick in a Reader's Digest article, "we release energy which enables us to create a richer life." No one living has enough emotion and vigor to fight the inevitable, and at the same time enough left over to create a new life. Choose one or the other. You can either bend with the inevitable sleet storms of life, or you can resist them and break. I saw that happen on a farm I own in Missouri. I planted a score of trees on that farm. At first they grew with astonishing rapidity. Then a sleet storm encrusted each twig and branch with a heavy coating of ice. Instead of bowing gracefully to their burden, these trees proudly resisted and broke and split under the load and had to be destroyed. They hadn't learned the wisdom of the forests of the North. I've traveled hundreds of miles through the evergreen forests of Canada, yet I have never seen a spruce or a pine broken by sleet or ice. These evergreen forests know how to bend, how to bow down their branches, how to cooperate with the inevitable. The masters of jiu-jitsu teach their pupils to bend like the willow, don't resist like the oak. Why do you think your automobile tires stand up on the road and take so much punishment? At first, the tire manufacturers tried to make a tire that would resist the shocks of the road. It was soon cut to ribbons. Then they made a tire that would absorb the shocks of the road. That tire could take it. You and I will last longer and enjoy smoother riding if we learn to absorb the shocks and jolts along the rocky road of life. What will happen to you and me if we resist the shocks of life instead of absorbing them? What will happen if we refuse to bend like the willow and insist on resisting like the oak? The answer is easy. We will set up a series of inner conflicts. We will be worried, tense, strained, and neurotic. If we go still further and reject the harsh world of reality and retreat into a dream world of our own making, we will then be insane. During the war, millions of frightened soldiers had either to accept the inevitable or break under the strain. To illustrate, let's take the case of William H. Cassilis of Glendale, New York. Here's a prize-winning talk he gave before one of my classes in New York. Shortly after I joined the Coast Guard, I was assigned to one of the hottest spots on this side of the Atlantic. I was made a supervisor of explosives. Imagine it, me, a cracker salesman, becoming a supervisor of explosives. The very thought of finding yourself standing on top of thousands of tons of TNT is enough to chill the marrow in a cracker salesman's bones. I was given only 2 days of instruction, and what I learned filled me with even more terror. I'll never forget my first assignment. On a dark, cold, foggy day, I was given my orders on the open pier of Caven Point, Bayonne, New Jersey. I was assigned to hold number 5 on my ship. I had to work down in that hold with 5 longshoremen. They had strong backs, but they knew nothing whatever about explosives, and they were loading blockbusters, each one of which contained a ton of TNT, enough explosive to blow that old ship to kingdom come. These blockbusters were being lowered by 2 cable slings. I kept saying to myself, suppose one of those cables slipped or broke. Oh, boy, I was scared. I trembled, my mouth was dry, my knees sagged, my heart pounded. But I couldn't run away. That would be desertion. I would be disgraced. My parents would be disgraced, and I might be shot for desertion. I couldn't run. I had to stay. I kept looking at the careless way those longshoremen were handling those blockbusters. The ship might blow up any minute. After an hour or more of this spine-chilling terror, I began to use a little common sense. I gave myself a good talking to. I said, look here, so you're blown up, so what? You'll never know the difference. It'll be an easy way to die, much better than dying by cancer. Don't be a fool. You can't expect to live forever. You've got to do this job or be shot, so you might as well like it. I talked to myself like that for hours, and I began to feel at ease. Finally, I overcame my worry and fears by forcing myself to accept an inevitable situation. I'll never forget that lesson. Every time I'm tempted now to worry about something I can't possibly change, I shrug my shoulders and say, forget it. I find that it works, even for a cracker salesman. Hooray, let's give 3 cheers and 1 cheer more for the cracker salesman of the Pinafore. Outside the crucifixion of Jesus, the most famous death scene in all history was the death of Socrates. 10,000 centuries from now, men will still be reading and cherishing Plato's immortal description of it, one of the most moving and beautiful passages in all literature. Certain men of Athens, jealous and envious of old barefooted Socrates, trumped up charges against him and had him tried and condemned to death. When the friendly jailer gave Socrates the poison cup to drink, the jailer said, "Try to bear lightly what needs must be." Socrates did. He faced death with a calmness and resignation that touched the hem of divinity. Try to bear lightly what needs must be. Those words were spoken 399 years before Christ was born. But this worrying old world needs those words today more than ever before. Try to bear lightly what needs must be. I've been reading practically every book and magazine article I could find that dealt, even remotely, with banishing worry. Would you like to know what the best single bit of advice about worry that I've discovered in all that reading? Well, here it is, summed up in 27 words, words that you and I ought to paste on our bathroom mirror so that each time we wash our faces, we could also wash away all worry from our minds. This priceless prayer was written by Dr. Reinhold Niebuhr. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. To break the worry habit before it breaks you, rule 4 is cooperate with the inevitable. Chapter 10. Put a stop-loss order on your worries. Would you like to know how to make money in Wall Street? Well, so would a million other people. And if I knew the answer, this book would sell for $10,000 a copy. However, there's one good idea that some successful operators use. This story was told to me by Charles Roberts, an investment counselor. I originally came up to New York from Texas with $20,000, which my friends had given me to invest in the stock market, Charles Roberts told me. I thought, he continued, that I knew the ropes in the stock market, but I lost every cent. True, I made a lot of profits on some deals, but I ended up by losing everything. I did not mind so much losing my own money, Mr. Roberts explained, but I felt terrible about having lost my friends' money, even though they could well afford it. I dreaded facing them again after our venture had turned out so unfortunately, but to my astonishment, they not only were good sports about it, but proved to be incurable optimists. I knew I'd been trading on a hit-or-miss basis, and depending largely on luck and other people's opinions, I had been playing the stock market by ear. I began to think over my mistakes, and I determined that before I went back into the market again, I would try to find out what it was all about. So I sought out and became acquainted with one of the most successful speculators who ever lived, Burton S. Cassels. I believed I could learn a great deal from him because he had long enjoyed the reputation of being successful year after year, and I knew that such a career was not the result of mere chance or luck. He asked me a few questions about how I had traded before, then told me what I believe is the most important principle in trading. He said, "I put a stop-loss order on every market commitment I make. If I buy a stock at, say, $50 a share, I immediately place a stop-loss order on it at $45. That means that when and if the stock should decline by as much as 5 points below its cost, it would be sold automatically, thereby limiting the loss to 5 points. If your commitments are intelligently made in the first place," the old master continued, "your profits will average 10, 25, or even 50 points. Consequently, by limiting your losses to 5 points, you can be wrong more than half the time and still make plenty of money." I adopted that principle immediately and have used it ever since. It has saved my clients and me many thousands of dollars. After a while, I realized that the stop-loss principle could be used in other ways besides in the stock market. I began to place stop-loss orders on other worries besides financial ones. I began to place a stop-loss order on any and every kind of annoyance and resentment that came to me. It has worked like magic. For example, I often have a luncheon date with a friend who's rarely on time. In the old days, he used to keep me stewing around for half my lunch hours before he showed up. Finally, I told him about my stop-loss orders on my worries. I said, "Bill, my stop-loss order on waiting for you is exactly 10 minutes. If you arrive more than 10 minutes late, our luncheon engagement will be sold down the river and I'll be gone." Man alive, how I wish I had the sense years ago to put stop-loss orders on my impatience, on my temper, on my desire for self-justification, on my regrets, and on all my mental and emotional strains. Why didn't I have the horse sense to size up each situation that threatened to destroy my peace of mind and say to myself, "See here, Dale Carnegie, this situation is worth just so much fussing about and no more"? Why didn't I? However, I must give myself credit for a little sense on one occasion at least. And it was a serious occasion, too. A crisis in my life. A crisis when I stood watching my dreams and my plans for the future and the work of years vanish into thin air. It happened like this. In my early 30s, I decided to spend my life writing novels. I was going to be a second Frank Narrowist or Jack London or Thomas Hardy. I was so in earnest that I spent 2 years in Europe, where I could live cheaply with dollars during the period of wild printing press money that followed the First World War. I spent 2 years there, writing my magnum opus. I called it The Blizzard. The title was a natural, for the reception it got among the publishers was as cold as any blizzard that ever howled across the plains of the Dakotas. When my literary agent told me it was worthless, that I had no gift, no talent for fiction, my heart almost stopped. I left his office in a daze. I couldn't have been more stunned if he had hit me across the head with a club. I was stupefied. I realized that I was standing at the crossroads of life and had to make a tremendous decision. Which way should I turn? Weeks passed before I came out of the daze. At that time, I had never heard of the phrase, put a stop-loss order on your worries, but as I look back now, I can see that I did just that. I wrote off my 2 years of sweating over that novel for just what they were worth, a noble experiment, and went forward from there. I returned to my work of organizing and teaching adult education classes, and wrote biographies in my spare time, biographies and nonfiction books, such as the one you're reading now. Am I glad now that I made that decision? Glad. Every time I think about it now, I feel like dancing in the street for sheer joy. I can honestly say that I have never spent a day or an hour since lamenting the fact that I am not another Thomas Hardy. One night a century ago, when a screech owl was screeching in the woods along the shores of Walden Pond, Henry Thoreau dipped his goose quill into his homemade ink and wrote in his diary, "The cost of a thing is the amount of what I call life, which is required to be exchanged for it immediately or in the long run." To put it another way, we are fools when we overpay for a thing in terms of what it takes out of our very existence. Yet that is precisely what Gilbert and Sullivan did. They knew how to create gay words and gay music, but they knew distressingly little about how to create gaiety in their own lives. They created some of the loveliest light operas that ever delighted the world. Patience, Pinafore, The Mikado. But they couldn't control their tempers. They embittered their years over nothing more than the price of a carpet. Sullivan ordered a new carpet for the theater they'd bought. When Gilbert saw the bill, he hit the roof. They battled it out in court and never spoke to one another again as long as they lived. When Sullivan wrote the music for a new production, he mailed it to Gilbert, and when Gilbert wrote the words, he mailed them back to Sullivan. Once they had to take a curtain call together, but they stood on opposite sides of the stage and bowed in different directions so they wouldn't see one another. They hadn't the sense to put a stop-loss order on their resentments, as Lincoln did. Once during the Civil War, when some of Lincoln's friends were denouncing his bitter enemies, Lincoln said, "You have more of a feeling of personal resentment than I have. Perhaps I have too little of it, but I never thought it paid. A man doesn't have the time to spend half his life in quarrels. If any man ceases to attack me, I never remember the past against him." I wish an old aunt of mine, Aunt Edith, had had Lincoln's forgiving spirit. She and Uncle Frank lived on a mortgaged farm that was infested with cockle burrs and cursed with poor soil and ditches. They had tough going, had to squeeze every nickel. But Aunt Edith loved to buy a few curtains and other small items to brighten up their bare home. She bought these small luxuries on credit at Dan Eversole's dry goods store in Maryville, Missouri. Uncle Frank worried about their debts. He had a farmer's horror of running up bills, so he secretly told Dan Eversole to stop letting his wife buy on credit. When she heard that, she hit the roof, and she was still hitting the roof about it almost 50 years after it had happened. I've heard her tell the story not once but many times. The last time I ever saw her, and she was in her late 70s, I said to her, "Aunt Edith, Uncle Frank did wrong to humiliate you, but don't you honestly feel that your complaining about it, almost half a century after it happened, is infinitely worse than what he did?" I might as well have said it to the moon. Aunt Edith paid dearly for the grudges and bitter memories that she nourished. She paid for them with her own peace of mind. When Benjamin Franklin was 7 years old, he made a mistake that he remembered for 70 years. When he was a lad of 7, he fell in love with a whistle. He was so excited about it that he went into the toy shop, piled his coppers on the counter, and demanded the whistle without even asking its price. "I then came home," he wrote to a friend 70 years later, "and went whistling all over the house, much pleased with my whistle." But when his older brothers and sisters found out that he had paid far more for his whistle than he should have paid, they gave him the horse laugh, and, as he said, "I cried with vexation." Years later, when Franklin was a world-famous figure, an ambassador to France, he still remembered that the fact that he had paid too much for his whistle had caused him more chagrin than the whistle gave him pleasure. But the lesson it taught Franklin was cheap in the end. "As I grew up," he said, "and came into the world and observed the actions of men, I thought I met with many, very many, who gave too much for the whistle. In short, I conceived that a great part of the miseries of mankind are brought upon them by the false estimates they have made of the value of things, and by their giving too much for their whistles. Gilbert and Sullivan paid too much for their whistles, so did Aunt Edith. So did Dale Carnegie on many occasions. And so did the immortal Leo Tolstoy, author of two of the world's greatest novels, War and Peace and Anna Karenina. According to the Encyclopedia Britannica, Leo Tolstoy was, during the last 20 years of his life, probably the most venerated man in the whole world. For 20 years before he died, from 1890 to 1910, an unending stream of admirers made pilgrimages to his home in order to catch a glimpse of his face, to hear the sound of his voice, or even touch the hem of his garment. Every sentence he uttered was taken down in a notebook, almost as if it were a divine revelation. But when it came to living, to ordinary living, well, Tolstoy had even less sense at 70 than Franklin had at 7. He had no sense at all. Here's what I mean. Tolstoy married a girl he loved very dearly. In fact, they were so happy together that they used to get on their knees and pray to God to let them continue their lives in such sheer heavenly ecstasy. But the girl Tolstoy married was jealous by nature. She used to dress herself up as a peasant and spy on his movements, even out in the woods. They had fearful rows. She became so jealous even of her own children that she grabbed a gun and shot a hole in her daughter's photograph. She even rolled on the floor with an opium bottle held to her lips and threatened to commit suicide, while the children huddled in a corner of the room and screamed with terror. And what did Tolstoy do? Well, I don't blame the man for up and smashing the furniture. He had good provocation. But he did far worse than that. He kept a private diary. Yes, a diary in which he placed all the blame on his wife. That was his whistle. He was determined to make sure that coming generations would exonerate him and put the blame on his wife. What did his wife do in answer to this? Why, she tore pages out of his diary and burned them, of course. She started a diary of her own, in which she made him the villain. She even wrote a novel entitled Whose Fault, in which she depicted her husband as a household fiend and herself as a martyr. All to what end? Why did these two people turn the only home they had into what Tolstoy himself called a lunatic asylum? Obviously, there were several reasons. One of those reasons was their burning desire to impress you and me. Yes, we are the posterity whose opinions they were worried about. Do we give a hoot in Hades about which one was to blame? No, we're too concerned with our own problems to waste a minute thinking about the Tolstoys. What a price these two wretched people paid for their whistle. 50 years of living in a veritable hell just because neither of them had the sense to say stop. because neither of them had enough judgment of values to say, "Let's put a stop-loss order on this thing instantly. We are squandering our lives. Let's say enough now." Yes, I honestly believe that this is one of the greatest secrets to true peace of mind, a decent sense of values. And I believe we can annihilate 50% of all our worries at once if we would develop a sort of private gold standard, a gold standard of what things are worth to us in terms of our lives. So, to break the worry habit before it breaks you, here is Rule 5. Whenever we are tempted to throw good money after bad in terms of human living, let's stop and ask ourselves these three questions. 1. How much does this thing I am worrying about really matter to me? 2. At what point shall I set a stop-loss order on this worry and forget it? 3. Exactly how much shall I pay for this whistle? Have I already paid more than it is worth? Chapter 11. Don't try to saw sawdust. As I write this sentence, I can look out of my window and see some dinosaur tracks in my garden. Dinosaur tracks embedded in shale and stone. I purchased those dinosaur tracks from the Peabody Museum of Yale University, and I have a letter from the curator of the Peabody Museum saying that those tracks were made 180 million years ago. Even a Mongolian idiot wouldn't dream of trying to go back 180 million years to change those tracks. Yet that would not be any more foolish than worrying because we can't go back and change what happened 180 seconds ago. And a lot of us are doing just that. To be sure, we may do something to modify the effects of what happened 180 seconds ago, but we can't possibly change the event that occurred then. There is only one way on God's green footstool that the past can be constructive, and that is by calmly analyzing our past mistakes and profiting by them and forgetting them. I know that is true, but have I always had the courage and sense to do it? To answer that question, let me tell you about a fantastic experience I had years ago. I let more than $300,000 slip through my fingers without making a penny's profit. It happened like this. I launched a large-scale enterprise in adult education, opened branches in various cities, and spent money lavishly in overhead and advertising. I was so busy with teaching that I had neither the time nor the desire to look after finances. I was too naive to realize that I needed an astute business manager to watch expenses. Finally, after about a year, I discovered a sobering and shocking truth. I discovered that in spite of our enormous intake, we had not netted any profit whatever. After discovering that, I should have done two things. First, I should have had the sense to do what George Washington Carver did when he lost $40,000 in a bank crash, the savings of a lifetime. When someone asked him if he knew he was bankrupt, he replied, "Yes, I heard," and went on with his teaching. He wiped the loss out of his mind so completely that he never mentioned it again. Here's the second thing I should have done. I should have analyzed my mistakes and learned a lasting lesson. But frankly, I didn't do either one of these things. Instead, I went into a tailspin of worry. For months, I was in a daze. I lost sleep and I lost weight. Instead of learning a lesson from this enormous mistake, I went right ahead and did the same thing again on a smaller scale. It is embarrassing for me to admit all this stupidity, but I discovered long ago that it is easier to teach 20 what were good to be done than to be one of the 20 to follow my own teaching. How I wish I had had the privilege of attending the George Washington High School here in New York and studying under Dr. Paul Brandwine, the same teacher who taught Alan Saunders of New York. Mr. Saunders told me that the teacher of his hygiene class, Dr. Paul Brandwine, taught him one of the most valuable lessons he had ever learned. "I was only in my teens," said Alan Saunders as he told me the story, "but I was a worrier even then. I used to stew and fret about the mistakes I had made. If I turned in an examination paper, I used to lie awake and chew my fingernails for fear I hadn't passed. I was always living over the things I had done and wishing I had done them differently, thinking over the things I had said and wishing I'd said them better. Then one morning, our class filed into the science laboratory, and there was the teacher, Dr. Paul Brandwine, with a bottle prominently displayed on the edge of the desk. We all sat down, staring at the milk and wondering what it had to do with the hygiene course he was teaching. Then, all of a sudden, Dr. Paul Brandwine stood up, swept the bottle of milk with a crash into the sink, and shouted, "Don't cry over spilt milk." He then made us all come to the sink and look at the wreckage. "Take a good look," he told us, "because I want you to remember this lesson the rest of your lives. That milk is gone. You can see it down the drain, and all the fussing and hair-pulling in the world won't bring back a drop of it. With a little thought and prevention, that milk might have been saved, but it's too late now. All we can do is write it off, forget it, and go on to the next thing." That one little demonstration, Alan Saunders told me, stuck with me long after I'd forgotten my solid geometry and Latin. In fact, it taught me more about practical living than anything else in my 4 years of high school. It taught me to keep from spilling milk if I could, but to forget it completely once it was spilled and had gone down the drain. Now, some readers are going to snort at the idea of making so much over a hackneyed proverb like "don't cry over spilt milk." I know it's trite, commonplace, and a platitude. I know you've heard it 1,000 times, but I also know that these hackneyed proverbs contain the very essence of the distilled wisdom of all ages. They have come out of the fiery experience of the human race and have been handed down through countless generations. If you were to read everything that has ever been written about worry by the greatest scholars of all time, you would never read anything more basic or more profound than such hackneyed proverbs as "don't cross your bridges till you come to them" and "don't cry over spilt milk." If we only applied those two proverbs instead of snorting at them, we wouldn't need this book at all. In fact, if we applied most of the old proverbs, we would lead almost perfect lives. However, knowledge isn't power until it's applied, and the purpose of this book is not to tell you something new. The purpose of this book is to remind you of what you already know and to kick you in the shins and inspire you to do something about applying it. I have always admired a man like the late Fred Fuller Shedd, who had a gift for stating an old truth in a new and picturesque way. While editor of the Philadelphia Bulletin and addressing a college graduating class, he asked, "How many of you have ever sawed wood? Let's see your hands." Most of them had. Then he inquired, "How many of you have ever sawed sawdust?" No hands went up. "Of course you can't saw sawdust," Mr. Shedd exclaimed. "It's already sawed, and it's the same with the past. When you start worrying about things that are over and done with, you're merely trying to saw sawdust." When Connie Mack, the grand old man of baseball, was 81 years old, I asked him if he had ever worried over games that were lost. "Oh, yes, I used to," Connie Mack told me, "but I got over that foolishness long years ago. I found out it didn't get me anywhere at all. You can't grind any grain," he said, "with water that has already gone down the creek." No, you can't grind any grain, and you can't saw any logs with water that has already gone down the creek. But you can saw wrinkles in your face and ulcers in your stomach. I had dinner with Jack Dempsey one Thanksgiving, and he told me over the turkey and cranberry sauce about the fight in which he lost the heavyweight championship to Tunney. Naturally, it was a blow to his ego. "In the midst of that fight," he told me, "I suddenly realized I had become an old man. At the end of the 10th round, I was still on my feet, but that was about all. My face was puffed and cut, and my eyes were nearly closed. I saw the referee raise Gene Tunney's hand in a token of victory. I was no longer champion of the world. I started back in the rain, back through the crowd to my dressing room. As I passed, some people tried to grab my hand. Others had tears in their eyes. A year later, I fought Tunney again, but it was no use. I was through forever. It was hard to keep from worrying about it all, but I said to myself, I'm not going to live in the past or cry over spilt milk. I'm going to take this blow on the chin and not let it floor me. And that is precisely what Jack Dempsey did. How? by saying to himself over and over, "I won't worry about the past." No, that would merely have forced him to think of his past worries. He did it by accepting and writing off his defeat and then concentrating on plans for the future. He did it by running the Jack Dempsey Restaurant on Broadway and the Great Northern Hotel on 57th Street. He did it by promoting prize fights and giving boxing exhibitions. He did it by getting so busy on something constructive that he had neither the time nor the temptation to worry about the past. "I have had a better time during the last 10 years," Jack Dempsey said, "than I had when I was champion." Mr. Dempsey told me that he had not read many books, but without knowing it, he was following Shakespeare's advice. "Wise men ne'er sit and wail their loss, but cheerily seek how to redress their harms." As I read history and biography and observe people under trying circumstances, I'm constantly astonished and inspired by some people's ability to write off their worries and tragedies and go on living fairly happy lives. I once paid a visit to Sing Sing, and the thing that astonished me most was that the prisoners there appeared to be about as happy as the average person on the outside. I commented on it to Lewis E. Laws, then warden of Sing Sing, and he told me that when criminals first arrive at Sing Sing, they're likely to be resentful and bitter. But after a few months, the majority of the more intelligent ones write off their misfortunes and settle down and accept prison life calmly and make the best of it. Warden Laws told me about one Sing Sing prisoner, a gardener, who sang as he cultivated the vegetables and flowers inside the prison walls. That Sing Sing prisoner who sang as he cultivated the flowers showed a lot more sense than most of us do. He knew that the moving finger writes, and having writ moves on, nor all your piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all your tears wash out a word of it. So why waste the tears? Of course we have been guilty of blunders and absurdities, and so what? Who hasn't? Even Napoleon lost 1/3 of all the important battles he fought. Perhaps our batting average is no worse than Napoleon's, who knows? And anyhow, all the king's horses and all the king's men can't put the past back together again. So, let's remember Rule 6. Don't try to saw sawdust. Part 3 in a nutshell. How to break the worry habit before it breaks you. Rule 1. Crowd worry out of your mind by keeping busy. Plenty of action is one of the best therapies ever devised for curing wibber-jibbers. Rule 2. Don't fuss about trifles. Don't permit little things, the mere termites of life, to ruin your happiness. Rule 3. Use the law of averages to outlaw your worries. Ask yourself, what are the odds against this thing's happening at all? Rule 4. Cooperate with the inevitable. If you know a circumstance is beyond your power to change or revise, say to yourself, it is so. It cannot be otherwise. Rule 5. Put a stop-loss order on your worries. Decide just how much anxiety a thing may be worth and refuse to give it any more. Rule 6. Let the past bury its dead. Don't saw sawdust.